I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of February. Before we get into the meat of the show, I'd like to thank the smart and engaging John Munson for filling in for me while I took the vacation of a lifetime with the entire family. And now we are back to all things political, which you always hear Mondays at 1 o'clock. And our guest this hour is Joan Walsh. Joan has written recently about Senator Gillibrand, who says Congress doesn't grasp real people's struggles, but she's optimistic anyway. Joan has written about life after Mitch. And she believes the 2016 GOP field got even worse. She writes about Jeb Bush's bad polls, Rand Paul rambling about the dangers of vaccines. She says Democrats are finally making actual populist policy proposals, but we ask, will they go anywhere? And of course, we'll be talking about Governor Scott Walker, who is now in England. The Hill reports today that Governor Walker will be in London this week as he looks to polish his foreign policy credentials in preparation for a possible 2016 presidential run. He is there as part of a trade mission and has plans to go to Israel later this year. Joan Walsh will talk about his foreign policy experience and how that may be a problem for him as he enters the presidential race. Of course, a lot of news here in Wisconsin related to the governor's budget, which we will talk about. And as always, we ever encourage that continual and fearless sifting and winnowing by which alone the truth can be found. And we welcome your phone calls at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Joan Walsh. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Welcome back from your vacation.
Thank you, Joan. My mind is on the beach, but I will I will soon enter the world of politics once again. Let's start with Governor Walker's trip to England, because I know you've written about his foreign policy experience or lack thereof. The Hill reporting today he's looking to polish his foreign policy credentials. He appears to be doing very well in very early polls in Iowa, New Hampshire, North Carolina. How do you explain that, and why do you think foreign policy may be problematic for him?
Well, you know, he gave a decent enough speech at a conservative gathering in Iowa a couple of weeks ago. It got a lot of national attention, and he's doing well, especially in the Iowa polls. I mean, it's the neighboring state, so there's a little bit of that favorite son thing going on. But, you know, I think it's going to be a lot like 2012, honestly. If you looked back at 2012, at one point, I said it was like a kid's t-ball game or championship. Everybody gets to be a winner. Everybody gets to hold the trophy for a little while, because people took turns, you know, at the top of the polling who were never going to be president. I mean, Herman Cain was up there at one point. So I'm not saying Scott Walker is a much more serious candidate than Herman Cain was, but there's a little bit of, newness and unfamiliarity and people not paying attention. So something like a decent speech can actually raise his profile. But at the same time, you know, a heightened profile means you're going to be getting a lot more attention and skepticism. And so we saw him on the Sunday shows on ABC This Week a couple Sundays ago completely melt down when asked a question about Syria. It was as if he didn't even quite know what our policy was there, what the airstrikes were about. And, you know, he got a tough interviewer in Martha Raddatz who just kept hammering him to the point where he said, you know, well, maybe we should be putting boots on the ground, which, you know, is a very extreme position. So I think he does need to bone up on foreign policy quickly. I don't know that going to London does it. These Republicans seem to think, like, that's the place to go. We're not really having a lot of trouble with our alliance with Great Britain right now. You know, I don't know what that gets them except their passport stamp. That's not really the kind of foreign policy experience they need. But Chris Christie just went and did the same thing. So I guess it's where they start.
As you well know, there's been a lot of controversy about the state budget address last week in the state of Wisconsin, particularly among people in the university system, with a proposed $30 million in higher education funding cut. How does that play nationally? Is that a story that receives national attention and will be a part of his story as he campaigns nationally?
I think it does. I mean, I think you saw the New York Times editorializing against it, not merely the budget cut, which is awful, but also the really unfortunate attempt to hack away at the wording of the Wisconsin idea and the undergirding of the state university system. And they were embarrassed by calling it a drafting error, but then I guess some emails surfaced showing that they had done it intentionally. I think that this is something where he may go too far. He doesn't really like the public sphere. He has it in for public workers. Apparently that includes public university professors. He's peddling the idea that they're lazy and that they don't do enough work and that they can easily absorb these cuts. And I don't think that that's something that the public, except, you know, outside the fringe of the far right, really agrees on. I think it's also interesting because it does serve to remind, you know, a national audience that he didn't graduate from college. And there are questions about, you know, his leaving Marquette. And so it's an odd issue. It may be an issue that some right-wing funders really appreciate, but I think it's a terrible issue, especially as he is getting a real new look from national Republicans. I don't see how this helps him.
And what about the Democrats? You and I have spoken before about this. It was before the last gubernatorial election, right before it, when we last spoke. What about the Democratic response in the state of Wisconsin, and I guess you could also say nationally, to some of these ideas? The Democrats don't seem to be particularly organized in their defense of their ideas.
No, I think that is disappointing, and I think that, you know, journalists reacted especially to the Wisconsin budget cuts, and I saw a lot of social media activity, but I don't think that the Democrats have really been poised to explain exactly why it's so dangerous and so damaging to the state, and damaging in a person that apparently wants to be our president. So, as always, I think he does outplay both state and national Democrats sometimes. That may change. National Democrats are getting more familiar with him. But the reaction has been very kind of grassroots and in the media, not so much by politicians.
Mm-hmm. You wrote recently about Jeb Bush on the heels of Mitt Romney's withdrawal from the race, the alleged GOP 2016 frontrunner. Would you describe him that way now? You mentioned his speech in Detroit where he was supposed to take on poverty and opportunity and claiming the mantle of reform conservative, but he didn't live up to that.
Yeah, I mean, he's not Scott Walker in the sense that he has a long record. He's known on the national stage. He comes from a prominent family. I don't think somebody like Jeb Bush really gets away with an introductory speech that talks in platitudes but really sidesteps any kind of solution to poverty or income inequality or these, stagnating wages and these things that, you know, I'm happy to see that Republicans are talking about them too. He's not a brand new face. He's not a brand new figure. It's really past time for him to be talking about the policies that he would stand behind. And, you know, like it or not, there is a kind of reform conservative, it's too small to call it a movement, but there are some people framing ideas mainly through the tax code, mainly through various family tax credits and tax cuts. But, you know, there's a conversation going on in the Republican Party about how to deal with these issues of income inequality. And there is a kind of fledgling agenda. He uses the term but doesn't even bother to associate himself even with the broad outline of reform conservatism, even with, you know, expanded family tax credits or anything like that. It was just so devoid of specifics. And then on top of it, he, you know, decides he's going to do it in Detroit, which really only serves to remind the national media that he, like Mitt Romney, opposed the auto restructuring, the auto bailout, which saved, you know, 1.9 million jobs by some estimates. So, and then while he's in Detroit, okay, he chose Detroit. Maybe he's going to talk to us about how his policies would revitalize a still struggling city. Nope, nope, he's not going to do that either. So I don't know what he thinks he's doing. He's kind of getting a pass for now, but I don't think that's going to last very long either. And he's not a neophyte. There should just be more there, and we're not getting it.
And as for the Democrats, the New York Times had an interesting front page story yesterday about Hillary Clinton, and they said that her economic plan is a quandary. She has advice from more than 200 policy experts on the economy. Isn't that a lot of experts?
It's a lot of experts. Yeah. A lot of people want to tell her what to do.
Really?
It's fascinating. And some of them, some of them are strong progressive economists, and I'm hoping she'll listen. You know, there's a lot of frustration and a lot of questions about what her economic platform is going to be like. There's a lot of worry that because she was the senator from Wall Street, that she might be too friendly to banks and big business. But we've talked about this before. She's not as progressive as I would like, but I actually think she's probably as progressive a person as is going to be elected president in the near future. And she's a little bit more progressive than she gets credit for. You know, in the 2008 campaign, even though she represented Wall Street, she came out in favor of getting rid of the, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here, Kathleen, but I know you've got a smart audience. The carried interest loophole that lets investment bankers pay a scandalously low tax rate on what are essentially their salaries, but they treat it as though it's investment income, and they pay capital gains rates instead of, you know, you and I paying rates,
yes,
on our salary, much higher rates on the work because we work for a living rather than having our money work for a living. And that takes a certain amount of bravery. Barack Obama, to my knowledge, still hasn't come out for that. I could be wrong, but it certainly wasn't, you know, a prominent fixture of his new tax proposals, for instance. So I think she's somewhat more progressive than a lot of people give her credit for. But, you know, she's now said she's putting, you know, or people around her have said she's putting off her announcement another couple months. I guess I understand that. Let's let the Republicans fire at each other and, you know, let that be the media story. But at the same time, it does kind of keep all this questioning about how centrist is she, how conservative, how radical, what's she going to do about the banks? We're not going to get answers for a while, and I think that leaves a vacuum. And so you've got all these groups on the left raising money to draft Elizabeth Warren, who doesn't want to be drafted. I think that's getting to be a little bit vexing to me, because I sort of wonder who's using whom. You know, are groups using their organizational strength to prop up, support, promote Elizabeth Warren, or are they using Elizabeth Warren to build their own organizational strength? I think it's more the latter than the former, mm-hmm, though I think the intentions are good.
And what would be different about 2016? Hillary Clinton, of course, didn't get the nomination 8 years ago, or 6 years ago now. It was Barack Obama, right, who seemingly came out of nowhere and was very attractive to Americans. And Hillary Clinton wasn't as attractive to Americans. Will she be more attractive now?
Well, you know, her poll numbers are terrific. She's the most admired woman. She beats everybody. She was the front runner in 2006, 2007 in those early polls, but not by very much. You know, maybe by 15 or 20 points, not by 40 or 50 or 60 points as she is over Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden and Martin O'Malley. She never had the dominant poll standing that she does now. And nothing is guaranteed. It's perfectly possible that she gets toppled. I also think it's slightly possible she doesn't run, but I don't expect that. But, you know, there are no guarantees. And I think the worst thing would be for her to run as the presumed front runner, to run. I think the mistake she made in 2008 was kind of running as the, you know, third term of Bill Clinton and the Clinton restoration and the person who was entitled to it. And she just, you know, really left herself open to an insurgent challenge and, you know, was surprised by it. But I think, you know, I think it was partly her own making. So she really can't act that way again. On the other hand, there's just no Barack Obama figure, even back in 2006 or 2007, before he declared, you knew that he was an extraordinary leader who, if he didn't run then, would run later. There's no one, you know, not to diminish, I don't know, Mark Nomad or Elizabeth Warren, who was wonderful, or Joe Biden, you know, who I think could be formidable. There's just nobody with the Obama story or, you know, the Obama organization. You know, the really interesting thing now is Joe Biden likes to talk about don't count me out, but he's not raising money or building a staff. Elizabeth Warren, not only is she saying I'm not running, but she's really not running. She's not building a staff. She's not going to Iowa and New Hampshire. She's not raising money. So, you know, nobody is doing the things the Democratic challengers were doing in 2006 and 2007 to get ready to make a run at Hillary Clinton. So, you know, and meanwhile, despite her delay in, you know, in declaring, there's a huge Ready for Hillary campaign, and there's a, you know, there's a lumbering apparatus waiting for her. It might even be too lumbering, but, mm-hmm. You know, she doesn't have to worry at this point about it, about money or bodies. She does have to worry about whipping that organization into shape and making it be, in, you know, getting it into fighting form and not fighting with each other like they did in 2008. Right.
Joan Walsh is our guest for All Things Political this Monday, editor-at-large for Salon.com, a political analyst for MSNBC, and we're talking politics this hour. We should say that Joan has strong connections to Wisconsin as well. She went to Shorewood High School, and she went to UW-Madison, so she has a good sense of what the Wisconsin idea is about and what the UW system is about. We started our conversation with the governor of the state in London this week as he looks to polish his foreign policy credentials. So we're looking at his role in the state of Wisconsin and what happened last week with the budget in addition to his possible 2016 presidential run. He is in England as part of a trade mission. Would you agree that he will face problems nationally because of his lack of experience in the foreign policy realm? Do you imagine that any of what was announced last week in Wisconsin will become part of a national debate as well? And we're welcoming phone calls. So here is how you reach us. We have a couple lines open for Joan right now. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So let's go to phone calls for Joan Walsh. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Charlie in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would define myself as conservative, and I look upon Scott Walker's campaign totally aghast because he's got too much work to do. He doesn't have a resume. He's got too much to finish before he starts thinking he should be running for another office. He's been a perennial candidate running every couple of years. He should need to do some leading, and he should do some governing before he chooses to become president. Thanks.
Thanks very much for the call. Joan.
Well, I know Republicans who agree with that. You know, the budget is not in good shape. He hasn't kept his job creation promises. The economy lags behind other Midwestern economies, and so really, the whole basis for his candidacy, I think, is that he stood up to Democrats and to public employees and beat them. He beat back a recall attempt. He's won 3 elections in 4 years. He's very proud of that. So it's a record of combativeness and of trouncing people that the far right despises. But it's not a record that I brought jobs to Wisconsin, I cut taxes, but revenues increased because we did so well. It's nothing like that. He has nothing like that to run on, quite the opposite. But in an age where there's really a fringe of the party that is particularly interested in humiliating Democrats and really standing up against, demonizing Democrats from President Obama on down, but not just President Obama, unions in particular, to that sector of the party, he believes he's going to be very attractive. But there may be some people who are part of that sector who also care about results. And when they start looking at what he actually has accomplished in Wisconsin, I don't think they're going to be hugely impressed.
Mm-hmm. Is it hard? There have been other governors who have run for president. What happens to a state? Because a presidential campaign has to take every ounce of energy and every minute of your day.
Yeah, you know, it really is not something that someone who was just reelected should be doing, in my humble opinion. Because especially in, you know, the last 8-16 years, the demands of the campaign, it starts earlier, it lasts longer. It's really more than a full-time job. So, you know, they wind up turning things over to their lieutenant governors, and, you know, I don't think it's a good deal for most states. So, you know, maybe he won't do it, but everything we're all hearing indicates mm-hmm. he's very excited about this, right?
We go to Jim in Milwaukee next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. What I'd like to talk about is just the general atmosphere of selfishness and lack of care and concern for other people that the Republicans put out. And it seems to me that in the larger context, the problem isn't that people aren't smart enough. It's just that they don't work hard enough. If you're going to get something done, you've got to read books. And you've got to read books that are in favor of the people that you're in favor of, but you also have to read books that are critical of the people that you're in favor of. And if you're on your toes, it shouldn't be too hard to come up with impeachable reasons for a whole list of presidents, even including Jimmy Carter, if you do a little reading. And the assault on education and the cuts on UW's system are based on the concept that if we have a good, strong public school system, there's an implication that we're all in this together and that we should be thinking, and we should be thinking independently. And that's the last thing that the Republicans want to deal with. And in fact, in America today, time and time again, there are things that come out that indicate that it's okay to cheat to win. Enron and the Wall Street movie by DiCaprio that we just saw, where the people were just enjoying themselves, they were taking the suckers for a ride, and the inflated football in the New England game, and just on and on and on that it's okay to cheat. And beyond that, it's more than that. It's not just okay to cheat. It's okay not to care about people. Imagine Jesus getting in a closed room with his disciples and saying that 47% of the people he couldn't work with. You know, you would never see that from Jesus, but it's okay from Mitch Romney.
Thank you very much, Jim, for your call. Let's zero in on this education, because this certainly is a big thing with Jeb Bush as well, who's done a lot of charter schools. The New Yorker had an interesting piece about him just last week or the week before. I don't know. I was on vacation, but I was reading it. And the same thing happening here in Wisconsin, is expansion of voucher programs, lots of charter schools, just a whole change in the public education system. What's behind that? What's the reason for that, do you think, Joan?
I think it's complicated, but it's driven, I think, by two main thrusts. Let me grant that some people behind this are genuinely concerned about student achievement and about low-income student achievement. I think there is a genuine concern among a lot of the people that we have to give them credit for good motives. But what's problematic is their analysis, and so it tends to wind up being something that's really a push for privatization. Maybe it's for for-profit, even for-profit schools and for-profit curriculum and for-profit educational enterprises, which Bush has supported himself. And it's also an attack on unions and, you know, even in a nonprofit setting, which most charters are nonprofit. They're not run by private businesses. The central analysis is that union rules prevent teachers, prevent parents, prevent students from creating a kind of community with high standards that is really going to close the education gap. And, you know, I sent my daughter to public school. She had a couple of not-so-great teachers. I'm not going to say that there are no bad apples or malingerers, but by and large, the teachers that I encountered in the public school system were wonderful people who were paying out of pocket for school supplies and books and field trips and all the things that, you know, you and I took for granted growing up that we got as part of our public education. That's not happening today, so teachers are providing that themselves. I think there's also, you know, a kind of fantasy that goes on where the only agency that we're really going to say is responsible for closing the economic gaps, the only agency that's really responsible for dealing with poverty, is the public school system. Kids do wind up there. They may not wind up in social services. We may not find them their families anyplace else. We may not help them when we do. They do come into the public school system. And I think we have not done nearly enough within the schools or around the schools to deal with the complicated set of issues that surround urban poverty and low student achievement there. So it's sort of a quick fix idea, and it's a blame the union idea, and it's a, you know, the private sector can do this stuff better sort of idea. And it's really wrongheaded. And I think there's all the research we've seen on charter schools, they're not necessarily better, and in some cases they're actually worse than comparable, you know, traditional public schools. So it's really a lot of hype for very little results.
Jim Walsh, our guest, and it's All Things Political you're listening to here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. She's editor-at-large for Salon.com and political analyst for MSNBC. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We've spent a good portion of the hour talking about Governor Scott Walker's presidential ambitions and his foreign policy trips, one to England, where he is this week, and also looking at what happened with the delivery of the state budget last week and how that would play in to a presidential run. We've talked about Hillary Clinton. We've talked about public education and vouchers. We've talked about Jeb Bush. Feel free to move us into other political territory if you'd like, and we will eventually have lines open. We'll have one right now. One line is open for you. Russ in Nina is our next caller. Joan, hey, Russ.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much for taking my question. Our country faces many issues, but the one I feel is the most pressing is we're divided as a country. We're simply totally divided. And Walker has... I guess, come out and said divide and conquer is one method of winning elections. How much do you think that will hurt him?
You know, I think it will hurt him with some Republicans, but I hate to say this, but I think it helps him with others. I think it is honestly part of why he is a national candidate. I don't expect him to get the nomination, but anything's possible. And I think that his constituency and his sort of claim to fame is that he is very proud of the divisions that he's heightened in the state. He didn't create them, you know, let's be honest, but he certainly heightens them. He's very proud. I mean, every speech he makes, including that speech that was so well received in Iowa a few weeks ago, he boasts about standing up to the unions and crushing the unions and, you know, surviving the recall as though, you know, there's another way of looking at a recall, that you did, you were such a divisive person and you put in place policies that were so outrageous to a significant sector of your state that you wound up being recalled. It's not really necessarily a badge of honor, but he wears it as one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he really sees himself as being, as having fought the battle with Democrats and humbled those Democrats. And that's what he wants to bring to a national stage. And so I think it's his calling card. I don't think it's going to be enough to win the nomination, certainly not to win the presidency, but it's the thing that I think is helping him, you know, imagine raising money and imagine building a national movement. I think it really is what he's counting on.
Well, put his politics, I guess you could say he's a pretty conservative Republican. Some have described him as a Tea Party Republican. When we've done an analysis of the state of the Democratic Party and the state of the Republican Party in recent years, it's been the consensus of many analysts, Joan, that the Republican Party, to win, has to be a more moderate party, that both sides need to be more moderate because that's where the American people are. And yet we're seeing a lot of candidates who are not moderates at all. Why is that happening now? Why wouldn't moderation be your road to election?
Because I think that despite what the analysts might say and despite what the demographic numbers and the polling numbers might tell us about the changes in the country, I think that there is still a foot in the Republican Party, a sense that John McCain was a moderate who was foisted upon us. Mitt Romney, despite what he said about being severely conservative, was at his heart a moderate. And we've had two moderates thrown at us, and they were losers. And, you know, George H.W. Bush before was a moderate who only, you know, served one term. He was defeated by Bill Clinton. So I think there's a sense that, you know, moderates have carried the day. Even George W. Bush isn't conservative enough for some of them, and certainly when it comes to government spending, he, you know, busted out the deficit. And there's really a sense that's not backed up, to my knowledge, by data, that the answer is to finally nominate a true movement conservative, whether it's someone like Ted Cruz or whether it's someone like Scott Walker, that, you know, give the right wing a chance to lead the party and see what we do. And, you know, I don't think there's polling evidence for that being the winning ticket, but that's a very strong emotional and political claim on the right. And, they, you know, I don't know if this is the year when they prevail. We'll see.
We'll see. Thanks, Russ, for the call. Email from Mike in Eau Claire wondering if Bill Clinton could be subconsciously sabotaging Hillary's campaign. Maybe he thinks it would be better for her if she weren't president.
Without more information about why
he would do that,
or specifically what he's done to,
right,
to, you know, to lead to that conclusion, I don't think so. Anybody who knows President Clinton says, you know, it's just his most fervent dream that she become our first woman president. So I don't get that much into psychoanalysis anyway. It's not what I'm credentialed in. So, you know, does he slip on the campaign trail and sometimes say dumb things? Yes. He certainly did in 2008, but I don't think it's out of any, you know, unconscious animus. I think he wants her to win.
George in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, George.
Yes.
Go right ahead.
I just want to make input about Governor Walker is doing tremendous jobs for the state of Wisconsin. But we have a concern about his education.
You have a concern that he's not a graduate, George? George, where are you? Well, I don't know where he is, so I'll just have to assume that's what he was going to say. Does it make a difference if you graduated from college or not on the national scene, Joan?
You know, I think it might make a difference. I don't know. I don't want to say that somebody can't be president who doesn't have a college degree. Lots of working class people didn't get the opportunity to go to college, and I don't want to rule them out. I think that one problematic thing for him is that questions do persist about why he didn't finish up at Marquette. And, you know, I'm not saying I subscribe to any of the conspiracy theories, but, you know, I think you're going to have a new generation of national reporters asking those questions again. So I think it becomes a liability in that sense. Not that they're going to find anything different or a smoking gun. I don't know. But the questions will be asked. And then the other part of it is I just think that, you know, this assault on the Wisconsin idea and this assault on the UW system, this system was the engine of how we built the middle class in Wisconsin and nationwide. And it's no accident that, you know, in California, public universities were free. They had some fees, but there was no tuition until Ronald Reagan became governor. The city of New York once was tuition free. We used to make education widely available to not just middle class, but working class kids because we thought that was good for us as an economy, and that we would be a much more competitive society. At some point in the 60s, there was a notion that these college students were getting uppity and didn't appreciate what they were being given, and so it should be taken away from them. They had all this free time to protest, and B, that, you know, it was something that we couldn't necessarily afford as a society. So I think that there's a constellation of issues around education that are going to be problematic for Governor Walker as he advances to the national stage.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Colleen and Nina next. Hi, Colleen.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad I'm following your statement that you just made. I'm still an instructor at the technical college. I taught full-time, retired, and went back as adjunct. Mm-hmm. I worked in healthcare my whole life. And I was right in the middle of the union busting. But anyways, that's beside the point. The point is, because I mistrust Scott Walker so much, and I don't like this divide and conquer. I see this as with his statement about Syria, putting boots on the ground. Has anyone ever speculated whether or not he might reinstitute the draft if he's president? Is that a possibility? Could he do that?
I don't know if he's been asked that. Do you, Joan?
I have never seen him ask that, or I've never seen him talk about that. So I don't worry about that too much, but I do worry about that, you know, he's taking foreign policy advice from very hawkish elements in the party and really doesn't know what he's talking about, to be honest. You can have a debate about our Syria policy, but, you know, one thing that interview showed is that he couldn't find his footing in that conversation. It was embarrassing, frankly. You know, I think it's really a question of what policies his funders support, because he doesn't seem to show any real interest in these questions, or hasn't, you know. And so, you know, I think that should be something that concerns even Republicans.
Joan Walsh is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. She is editor-at-large for Salon.com, and she is a political analyst for MSNBC. And we're welcoming phone calls. She knows her politics, as you can tell, and our governor is making a lot of national news and certainly a lot of news here in the state, so he's dominating this conversation, but we're also talking about the Democrats and their likely candidate, Hillary Clinton, and we're welcoming your phone calls on any political issue. We'll be okay for you to call in on. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joan Walsh is here now. We go next to Michelle in Toma. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I've lived in Toma, Wisconsin my whole life, and my daughter went to a public school, and she thrived in the public school. We are actually what you would consider below the poverty level as far as family. But she was able to go to Ripon College on a very large scholarship that they gave her. She competed for these scholarships.
Good for her.
And she was an honor roll student and a student ambassador and all this stuff. She really worked hard to get to where she could go to college because she knew the money wasn't there from us, and she has no grandparents. So for Republicans to tell families that, well, you can go to your parents or you can go to your grandparents and get the money from them, it's not that easy. Like in my situation, my daughter doesn't have any grandparents, so the option wasn't there. But nevertheless, I think it's a travesty that he would take $300,000 out of the UW system when we're trying to educate the next generation and so on, who are going to be taking care of our country, they are going to be running our country, and they need to have this education.
Well, there is something. Some have said, Joan, that it really is a lot of this is a discussion of what our values are as well. Are our values to be educated in so many different fields so that we are informed citizens who can bring ideas to all parts of the state and beyond the state and be good public servants? Or are we to train ourselves to enter the workforce where jobs are needed? Do we want people from the state to be looking after the environment in addition to others to make sure that we're good environmental stewards? How do we care for the poor among us? I mean, a lot of these issues are value issues about who we are as human beings, aren't they?
They are, and I think they are also value issues about who, if you've spent time living there, as I have, who we are as Wisconsin people. And, that's why, Wisconsin was one of the earliest states to begin, maybe the first state to acknowledge collective bargaining.
Yes.
And so he takes aim at collective bargaining. Wisconsin had one of the earliest and most extensive and most progressive public university systems. And so he takes aim at the public university system and the Wisconsin idea. So that's that's an outdated idea. These are outdated ideas. And the alternative ideas really do pit people against each other, tell people that, they're not working hard enough. That Mitt Romney did say that students should ask their parents or their grandparents for a loan to go to college or start a business. And during that 2012 campaign, he literally did say that. That's the worldview. That's the mindset that doesn't understand how hard families are working and what it's like not to be able to do that for your children when it used to be, just a few hundred dollars a semester to go to the University of Wisconsin. It was not prohibitive. So he is taking aim at I think, very core American values and Wisconsin values. But, again, he's won three elections, so he's tapping into something, some kind of resentment or sense that we can't afford to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. That's kind of depressing.
Well, and you don't want to just target one person, because it would seem to me that that nobody's been very good politically at taking on this issue of this huge wealth disparity in this country and people who are working really hard and not making as much money as they did back in the 70s. And why is that? And nobody's really taking on that issue. The Democrats aren't either, really.
They're starting to, but right. They really haven't. I mean, you and I talked about this when my book came out, that the Democrats were kind of scared by what happened to them in the 60s and the 70s. Mm-hmm. They got associated with, the party of big spending, and they really went out of their way. They kind of turned their back on their own legacy of the New Deal, the Wisconsin idea, the expanded public education, expanded funding for the middle class. They turned their back on that out of fear and began competing with Republicans to see, who could lavish more wealth on Wall Street, who could deregulate faster.
Right.
I think there was a really shameful period for the party where there wasn't enough advocacy for people who were losing ground in this economy. Starting to change, rhetorically at least, it's starting to change, but not fast enough.
Lynn and Eau Claire, thank you very much, and all the best to your family and your daughter. Lynn and Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, Kathleen, and to your guest, Joan. It's coming from the Republicans who hold themselves the party of family values. Scott Walker is a bully. I have two sons who are policemen. If they were bullies, they'd lose their job. If my 7-year-old grandson was a bully at school, he'd be expelled. And somehow the party of family values lauds and applauds this man who is a bully. And I'm not understanding how that fits in with anyone's values.
Why do you think he's a bully, Lynn?
Why do I think? Because it is just, because nothing, and I don't want to sound, I'm using they said and those. I don't see anything backed up. What I see is cockiness. I don't see anything truth. You know, I'm not, you know, there is, I see very, very little truth. I hear very little truth. And I just see a very, very cocky individual who is, you know, comes across to me as a schoolyard bully.
Okay, Lynn, thanks very much. I don't know if you want to respond to that, Joan, but.
Yeah, I think I would just go back to what I said before, which is that he really does. His national platform is based on the fact that, you know, he's put people in their place and he's prevailed. He's trounced unions and Democrats. And there's an element, I suppose, you could see that as bullying. At the very least, it really puts a premium on combativeness and not, you know, not figuring out how to unite people and come together to solve the problems that we genuinely have, you know, in all of our states and nationally.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is something that you wish would happen politically and in all realms, that people would gather around the table if they have different political viewpoints, so be it. They sit down and take on a discussion of what the issues are, and alas, that just is not happening at the state level and certainly not the national level. And you have to wonder if that serves anybody very well.
Well, yeah, you know, when the president came out with some of his State of the Union proposals and it was, you know, hailed as some kind of radical break, I pointed out a lot of his tax proposals, expanded tax credits, these either came from Republicans or have been at least endorsed by Republicans. And it seems to me like maybe 20 years ago, the two parties, nobody would have gotten everything, but Republicans would have picked out the four or five tax credit proposals that the president put forward that they like, that have been in their bills, and said, okay, we're not going to give you everything, but these five things would make a difference for American families. So let's just get those done, mm-hmm. and then let's go back and fight over the things we disagree on. On immigration reform, too, I mean, the president has said this. Okay, you know, there's some things that we're far apart, but can't we take the smaller things and just get them done? But I think that the modern Republican Party, especially in dealing with Barack Obama, has just been determined not to give him victories. So to give him, you know, four out of 20 proposals in his State of the Union address is to give him four victories, and that's the way they see it, rather than, hey, we found some common ground and we can solve some problems with these four ideas that we actually kind of like. So let's do that, and then we'll go back to fighting, and then we'll run against, you know, a Democrat for president, but we will have gotten that done. I feel like that's the way things worked when we, you know, 15, 20 years ago, even under, you know, honestly, even under Bill Clinton and even under George Bush, you know, Democrats came together to support No Child Left Behind. Democrats voted for his tax cuts. Some Democrats did. You know, Democrats supported a lot of his agenda in the early years and then opposed things that they didn't support. So Obama's really the first president to have zero cooperation from the other party in Congress, zero.
Joan, thank you. Always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for being with us again.
Oh, thanks for having me. I always enjoy it, Kathleen.
Good.
To hear that.
Glad to hear that. Joan Walsh, our guest this hour. Joan is editor-at-large for Salon.com. She's a political analyst for MSNBC, and she's the author of What's the Matter with White People? And she has Wisconsin ties, went to UW-Madison and Shorewood High School, so she understands the Wisconsin idea, etc. All things political you always hear on Mondays at 1 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. And we have this place to go for comments, too. There are certain issues that you just want to talk about, and you can do that on Facebook. It's one of the things I like about Facebook. You put your comments there and we read them, and it's all kinds of different opinions, and that's a good thing. So if you didn't get on the air today, please go there if you can and leave your comment. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We have a lot of comments there already for our second hour program on paid maternity leave, and we'd love to hear your thoughts about our political discussion this hour as well. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return and talk about paid maternity leave, should we have it in this country?